Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And you know, we've heard in Mixergy interviews and courses, entrepreneurs tell us that the best place to find a business idea, well, maybe not the best, but one of the great places to do it is to look in online forums and see what people complain about and then build a business that solves that complaint and sell it. Sell the products, sell the solution. Anyway, today's guest says that a post in an online forum pushed him to start a business. This is a concept that he used, and I invited him here to talk about how he did it. His name is Girish Mathrubootham. How did I do with the name, Girish?
Pretty good for the first time.
Can you pronounce it right? I want to be accurate.
Yeah, it's Girish Mathrubootham.
Girish Mathrubootham.
Yes. Actually, Mathrubootham is my father's name. So in India, a lot of people don't have this concept of first name and last name. So my last name is my father's first name. And then my children take my first name as their last name.
And their last name is Girish.
Yes.
Oh, cool. And you are the founder of Freshdesk Customer Support Software. It's software that we use to talk to customers, to give them help. And we'll find out more about it. All thanks to... Actually, you know what? Before I get my sponsor, as I said that, I looked at your face and it seemed like you were not happy with the way I described Freshdesk, right? How would you describe it?
So Freshdesk is online customer support software for the next generation. So in one line, I would say traditionally customer support used to mean customers talk to a company via phone or email, but today's customers, they talk to the company, they want to talk to other customers, and then if they're upset, they are talking about you on Twitter and Facebook, and Freshdesk helps a brand actually connect with customers across all these channels and manage those conversations.
And multiple people who are having those conversations, and it allows them all to sync up. All right, that's so much better than I did it, and I want to get into my sponsorship message and then ask you a few questions about this. And my sponsor is TopTal. In a past interview, my guest said, hey, you should do a case study. Tell people how TopTal helped someone else instead of just telling them why TopTal is such a great company. And so I've got the story of Sharif, who is a former Expedia exec who wanted to launch his own travel site. And he tried a bunch of independent developers that he looked that he found online on freelance websites. And he discovered that the ratings that were on those sites just weren't accurate. And so he ended up giving them tests and spending a whole lot of time looking for the right freelancer. And when you're launching a business, you just don't have that kind of time. He said his success ratio was somewhere around 1 out of 20 people. And he was wasting a lot of time. So then he hired TopTal. He said, can you help me find people? Here's my vision. Here's what I need. Here's how I work. And TopTal found people for him. In fact, he engaged with four developers from TopTal. One of them ended up working for him for over a year. The site launched, and today he's a happy TopTal customer. And he's the kind of person that You know, Girish, I've got to call myself out. I don't think I'm doing such a great sponsorship spot here. I'm trying to tell somebody else's story, and I'm catching myself just tripping over my own words. But I'll get better at it. For now, what I'll say is if you're looking for a developer and you want to find someone who's the right cultural fit, who you can work with quickly and know that they're top of their business, TopTal is a network of developers who are proven to be the top of their game, proven to be among the top 3% among their peers. Go to TopTal.com and see why so many entrepreneurs use them. TopTal.com. Wow, Girish, a lot of tripping up, but I want to keep getting better and better at the way that I do these messages. I saw as I was doing a case study, I saw you smile, and I figured you thought that is the approach. What do you think?
Is the approach for what?
To doing a sponsorship message, to do...
Yeah, I think it was definitely a much better approach because I was just smiling because I didn't figure out that just putting out the name is not much, but you telling... what the company does is actually a much better way of doing it. Yes.
All right. I don't do any edits. I don't remove things when my guests screw up. So I'm going to keep all my mistakes in there and let people watch me as I screw up and definitely get better and better at doing my sponsorship message. All right, TopTal, thank you for being a sponsor. And Girish, I said it was an online forum that pushed you to get started with this idea. The forum was Hacker News, right?
Yes.
What was the comment that you saw there? And I know there's some backstory, but help me understand what you saw that day on Hacker News.
Okay, so I think this was on May 18th, 2010, when it was post-lunch reading on Hacker News, just casual browsing. I was actually not thinking about starting a startup. So I had two kids in school. I was living with my wife in Chennai, so I had a home mortgage. So it was not the ideal situation to jump into entrepreneurship. But what happened was I saw an article on Hacker News where there was a help desk company called Zendesk. It was a startup at that time, started in 2007. So in 2010, they had increased their prices by up to 300% on their existing customers. And naturally, the customers were pretty upset and they were taking apart the company on TechCrunch forums, TechCrunch comments, and on the company forums and on Hacker News. So I was just reading this as I was reading this, there was a comment from Mark Ransom, who is the CEO of RansomSoft, where it said, it just shows that if somebody can come and build the right product with the right set of features, they can take all of this market away. Now, that was like the eureka moment for me because, like, to give you some background, I had built 4 help desks all on-premise in my previous career. So I knew the space, and I also knew that SaaS was booming. And so that was the one final push or the slap that I needed to kind of jump into entrepreneurship, if you may. But the backstory
One sec, before you get into that, the complaint, I'm looking at the post here, and one of the big complaints was about prices. In fact, this is Ryan Allen who said, if they ever had lower prices for little guys, they'd have got us, meaning that they would have gotten Ryan Allen. It seems like if people are just complaining about the price and you jump in and say, I'm going to offer a lower price, that just doesn't seem like enough. Frankly, because help desk software is not such a big expense considering all the other expenses the companies have. And second, if you compete only on price, then the company you're competing with can lower their prices and eliminate the one advantage you had. So were you already starting to think of more than price, or was it just price at that point?
So price was one factor. I wouldn't say it was not. Mm-hmm. But I think this the idea that we had, so for example, the company we started is called Freshdesk, right? So,
right.
So I think I should tell you what is the fresh part of Freshdesk, because everybody thinks help desk is boring, right? So and it's just another help desk. So I'll give you the story that happened in 2009. Mm-hmm. When I was moving from Austin. I was working in Austin, Texas, and I was moving back to India. Mm-hmm. So there is a online community forum called R2I Club Forums. Okay. So this is Return to India Club Forums.
Okay.
Where most Indians who are going back to India would actually look up things like shipping providers or say schools for kids and real estate in India and a variety of topics. So I actually went there, got a recommendation for a shipping provider, and then shipped all my stuff. And when 2.5 months later, the stuff arrived at my home in Chennai, and my TV was broken. So my large screen LCD TV was broken.
Okay.
And I had insurance. I had purchased insurance from the company. So I thought it should be a pretty easy, straightforward way to get the money back. So I actually had to email the company, like, The 28 threads went on. I had to submit like a load of documents. Like they asked me for the original purchase receipt, the bank statement showing that transaction, and everything. Like the estimate from the Samsung dealer to how much it would cost to repair it. But after 6 months, the money was still not in my bank. It was just, I was totally frustrated because it was not going anywhere. And at that point, I had just given up. I no longer cared about the TV. I really wanted to kind of, I wanted revenge, right?
Okay.
So what I did was I went to R2A Club Forums and took pictures of my TV and shared my entire story online. And you know what? Within 2 days, the president of the company came there, apologized, and the money was in my bank. So what I realized was, as somebody who has been building 4 customer support solutions, this was a paradigm shift in customer support for me. What I couldn't get accomplished in 6 months through traditional channels like email and phone, suddenly was the ticket was resolved in 2 days, and I realized that as a customer, I had social power. So when I take my problem online, I get faster service. Now, I was also looking at Twitter. 2010 was the year where customer service moved on Twitter. So there were many customers like me who were realizing that they had social power. And I knew that most of the traditional help desk software out there were just focused on email and phone ticketing. So it was not about Zendesk alone. So the whole market was up for grabs. And I used to work as VP of product management for a company called Zoho. I was in the managed engine division of Zoho. So I could also see, I had a ringside view to how SaaS adoption was growing. And I could see that Zendesk was probably one of the companies that was in the space, but still not really big by any means. And I could see the paradigm shift in customer support with all these social channels and online community forums and LinkedIn groups and Facebook groups. So I thought, that's the opportunity for Freshdesk.
Why didn't all of that get you to start the company? Why did it take a Hacker News post to make you say, I'm jumping in and creating it? Why not the experience that you had with the moving company, the things that you'd seen on Twitter, and the rest that you learned from Zoho? Why didn't all that coalesce? Why did it take a Hacker News post?
So I think, as they say, a good life is the enemy of a great life.
Uh-huh.
So I had a pretty good life at Zoho. I was heading the managed engine division. Like, I was not actively... So all these things were subconsciously happening. I was not thinking about entrepreneurship. So even though, like, I always wanted to do it, at that point of time, it was the final push was the comment. So it was actually a sudden decision and not a planned multi-year addition or a...
I see. And you know what? Tell me if this is true too, that there was something about that thread. I remember reading it at the time. So much anger, so much frustration, so many people talking about why Zendesk's prices were unfair and why Zendesk was too powerful and all that stuff. And was it the avalanche of criticism that also helped?
Yeah. So basically, I was just thinking, for a customer support company, these guys don't have, like, this company doesn't have a lot of happy customers. That's it. And I think it's a pretty basic lesson for anybody in entrepreneurship, that you don't suddenly go and raise prices on your customers, right? So when you are in a SaaS business, so there is a contract, like, even though there's no signed contract, there is a implicit contract that the customer pays you a certain amount of money. So you can't just imagine your cable provider or your electricity provider suddenly gives you a bill which is three times what you paid last month, right? Well, you would... It would seem unfair to you. So that's what happened, actually.
I see. All right. And they did correct it. They understood that their customers were right on that, and they corrected it. So if all you had was an understanding that people didn't like the price, that wouldn't be enough. But you did, as you said, notice that people were complaining on Facebook and Twitter and interacting with companies there too. And there needed to be a solution that did all that. That people wanted multi-product support, and you needed a solution that did that. You mentioned a little bit about your background. One of the things that I know that you did before was you ran a company called MindSphere. You founded it, actually, right?
Yes.
And you told April Dykeman in your Mixergy pre-interview that the lesson you took away from that was make something people want. What was MindSphere, and why do you feel it did not make something that people wanted?
So I think I also had a company called Expert Labs in 1999. I'll tell you both the stories quickly so that I where I understood the difference. Mm-hmm. So in 1998-99, when I was running Expert Labs, it was a Java training company. Mm-hmm. And before the .com bust, everybody, Java was such a rage, and like, anybody who could spell Java on their resume was hired. So I was able to create a business selling or teaching Java courses, right? Everybody wanted to learn Java. So the only thing I had to convince the prospective student was why they should learn from me. That was so much easier compared to 2001, when after the .com burst, so there was so much confusion in the market that even Java wasn't relevant anymore. And I had to kind of convince people that why Java is still relevant. And then comes the sale of why they should learn from me. So I think that's where I really understood that, okay, if there is inherent demand or when people want something, mm-hmm. Like, it's always better to ride that wave and cater to that rather than trying to fight perception and common common behavior.
I see. All right. So you saw that there was a wave, And so what happened in MindSphere?
So in MindSphere, it was probably the worst timing. And you have to understand, in India, 2001 was the year when nobody actually joined computer science because of the dot-com bust. People wouldn't join BE computer science. They thought IT was over. And I knew that IT is the future of India, but you also have to understand at that point of time, I had probably four and a half years experience, social pressures of marriage. Today, it's so romantic and sexy to be an entrepreneur. In believe me, in 2001, especially in India, it was not. And also, I would say that it seemed like a safer bet to kind of join a good product company rather than just focusing on a training business, which was seasonal. I had understood that people join training courses only when they see a job at the end of the course. So that makes it very seasonal during boom times and bust times. So I thought, let me pick up more valuable skill in terms of what I wanted to do. And the idea was always somewhere down the line, I would try again.
Okay. But did MindSphere do okay? I get what you're saying about right away. When everyone's excited about Java and you're saying, hey, I've got Java training, it's not that much harder to convince them. What happened to MindSphere, though? It seems like there you felt like there wasn't much of a wave. You launched the business and...
Yeah, so basically it started off well. As soon as I landed, I had... So MindSphere was much more than just Java training. It had like ATG, Dynamo, WebLogic. I don't know if you remember all these things. These were all part of the dot-com days. And so I was able to launch courses for all these trainings. In fact, the first week when I landed in India, so I had a corporate training offer from Cognizant Technologies, and it started well. But then what was clear was the consumer market was really confused, and it was going to be a long road to survival. And see, I had quit my job in the US and I went back with a big plan on doing a franchisee model of a training company. And I wanted to thrive and grow. I didn't want to survive in a negative environment. So I thought the timing is not right. So I shut it down in a few months and joined AdventNet, which is today called as Zoho.
Right. That was 2002. You worked there till 2005. Zoho was the big training ground. You did customer support software for Zoho. Is that right?
No, I did IT help desk software, network monitoring software, applications management software, and so on.
Okay. All right. So you got a lot of experience there. You also found your co-founder there.
Yes.
How'd you guys connect, and why was he the right person for you to found Freshdesk with?
So Shan and I have worked together for close to 8 years. And he was my technical architect at a network monitoring product that I was building. That was my first product, actually. Mm-hmm. So I think we complemented each other really well. I was the product manager and the business guy. He was the hardcore techie and the coder. So, and we always, we built a great rapport over the years. So even if we don't complete the sentences, there was so much understanding that he would know what I would say. And also in terms of UI, UX, when a designer brings a UI, when he sees it, he knows that whether I'm going to approve it or not. And there was so much understanding. And I think it just felt right for me to ask him. And when I asked him after reading the Hacker News post that, can we do this? I have an idea to build a support company. And he didn't even think for 5 minutes. He immediately said yes. And the interesting part of the story is, in March 2010, I had actually convinced him to buy a home along with me. So both of us had home mortgages. And in May, we decided to kind of start. So,
and quit Zoho and go do this thing.
Yes.
And it came close to losing it all, as people will hear in a moment. It was not easy. You decided to do it full time. Why? Why not just stick around at Zoho and do this on the side and build it slowly and then quit?
Well, that's exactly what we also thought, probably not long term, but even a few weeks I tried it. But see, for me, it was really, really hard because I'm very passionate. I was not able to switch on and switch off between Zoho and Freshdesk. In my mind, if something goes in, I'm 100% or zero. So, it didn't feel right to do that. So, basically, I actually emailed my boss and CEO, Sridhar Vembu, before I told my wife.
Wow. So that she couldn't dissuade you and get you to stay.
Yeah, she was pretty upset and she really didn't want to do, she couldn't understand why I'm doing it, because everything was going well and I was I had a company car and good salary and and a nice house, and she couldn't understand why the hell did I need to do all this, right? But now she understands, and now she's happy.
I get it, and I also get the focus. I work that way too, that if I'm fully focused, then I get a lot done. If I can't get focused, if I have the distraction of working full-time and then coming and doing this, then my mind is not ever fully on one thing and I can't ever get momentum with it. You know, there's something that one of the initial problems that you had is one that I didn't realize until I moved to Argentina. Just getting a payment processor, the kind of thing that we in the U.S. just take for granted, you had a challenge with that. What was the challenge?
Yeah, so basically when... In India, the Reserve Bank of India has a rule that you can't store credit cards on a secure vault and automatically charge customers. So even today, it's not possible.
Wait, so Indian companies can't do recurring payment?
Yes.
They have to. So if you have a SaaS product where you have to charge your customer every month, how do Indian companies do it? Or what does the government expect Indian companies to do? Send a bill every month?
Probably, yes.
Wow. So how do you get around that?
So actually, I incorporated Freshdesk in the US even before incorporating in India. Because, see, SaaS as a business model is the lifeline of our business, right? So that was very clear. So it didn't matter to me that we didn't have a product built. So I just incorporated in the US. In fact, I wrote a blog post on how to incorporate a US company from outside the USA, which is very, very popular. If you Google it, it's number one. And I still keep getting two or three support calls from entrepreneurs from around the world asking me about advice. And I actually did it for one of my previous bosses who asked me that he was considering to incorporate in the US and he wanted me to send him an email with the steps. I told him, instead of sending you an email, I'll write a blog post. So and I didn't actually realize that it was such a big thing. But I think even today, that's probably... either top one or two posts in Freshdesk after all these years.
Is it hard to do? Is it hard for a non-American to create a US-based company?
So I think the entire process is somewhat hard, but to incorporate the company is pretty straightforward. And to get an EIN number, the employer identification number, you would have to call, a specific number in Philadelphia or Pittsburgh or some place. And then the hardest part is getting a bank account, and then after the bank account, getting a merchant account.
I see. So actually creating the account is not hard. Getting the tax ID is not hard. It's the bank loan it's the bank account that's tough.
Bank and merchant account. And you have to understand in 2010, there weren't things like Stripe.
Right. So what do you do to create a bank account? I've got the article here in front of me, but that's an important thing to talk about.
Yeah, actually, there was someone on Quora who actually helped me open a bank account. And this is where I think these are the real angels, where the person didn't know me. I went and asked a question on Quora. And those days, Quora was really, really a very influential set of people. And I think Quora did the onboarding part really well. So when I asked a question about how can I get a bank account in the US without actually visiting? So I had a social security, so I should say that I had SSN. So, and then there was this... gentleman who was living in this UK, I forget his name, and he actually offered to introduce me to the vice president of Silicon Valley Bank. And so he did, and I followed up, and Silicon Valley Bank actually asked me for a pitch deck, right? And I was thinking, I'm opening a savings bank account, and why are these guys asking me for a pitch deck as if they're going to VC fund? They're not VCs to fund me. But then I took the call. I told them I'll send them a pitch deck and meet them when I come. But I think I managed to convince them to help open an account. And then went with Braintree, again, talked to them and convinced them to give us a merchant account. And I think
once you have a bank account, getting Braintree or getting Stripe or anyone else is not that hard, right? They just want to know a bank account. They want to know that you're a US company, or now international companies are okay too.
Yeah, that is right. That is true. But there is also a small element of risk involved with the merchant account. So because you're a SaaS business, you could charge customers annually, and then you could go out of business in the customers who paid for annual, but in 1 or 2 months if they ask for chargebacks. So there was a 6-month revolving credit, which Braintree put, which means if a customer pays us, a portion of the money would come to us only after 6 months. And similarly, Silicon Valley Bank would give us a credit card, wouldn't give us a credit card unless we put a collateral loan. So we actually had to deposit money. So if I had a $25,000 credit card, so I had to deposit $25,000 into the account and then get a collateral back credit card. So it was not easy.
I always forget how much harder it is to work when you're outside the U.S. I mean, I accidentally called you with a different Skype account earlier, and it was because when I was in Argentina, I couldn't log into my PayPal account and pay for a phone number, and I needed a U.S. number. I couldn't do it. So I asked a friend, can you please create a Skype account for me, and with your PayPal account, just pay for it. I'll take care of you later on, and she did it. It was those little things that used to really bug me.
Yes.
All right, but you did it. You found a way to make it work. We entrepreneurs are hungry people. We always figure out some kind of solution. And then today we start talking about it so that other people can learn from us too. You rented an office. Office was $150 a month. That's one of the nice things about being in India, right? That some costs are actually lower. But you still needed money. And this was a surprise to me. The money came to you from Microsoft, right? The original cash?
Yeah. So I think... we were always trying to get attention or publicity. Like, see, my learnings have been that if you want to attract VC funding, you don't actually go and I didn't go and ask to be introduced to VCs. I focused on doing things which would generate inbound interest to the company. So one of the things was the Microsoft BizSpark, where we participated in the India Startup Challenge and 438 startups had applied and we were one of the 15 finalists. And I was actually not going to apply because I had a Mac and this form had silver light and it kept crashing multiple times. I'd almost given up, but somebody pushed me to apply and I did. And we ended up winning it. It was $40,000 in cash. It's cash, no debt, no equity. So it was free money. So that really helped. And then two of my friends had also invested 25K each. So that was enough for us to bootstrap.
You know, Girish, I'm always wondering whether those competitions are worth doing. I know you won, but considering the work that goes into winning, doesn't it make more sense to spend that time talking to investors, even if they're angel investors? Because there, it's not 400 people trying to win one prize. It's you trying to convince somebody that they could make money from you. And even if you fail to convince them, you still learn how to hopefully convince the next person.
Yeah, so I think each company is different. But what I think is, at least if you are able to generate inbound interest, like if it doesn't matter if you don't win. Of those 15 companies, I think 5 or 6 of them got funded because the people in the audience, the angel investors and the VCs, actually saw something that they liked.
I see.
So it's a bit like dating, right? So you have to play a little bit hard to get interest rather than just chasing every VC and trying to get introduced. Sometimes it works. Many times the VCs are, a lot of times you can't get to the VC, you're dealing with the associate and they are seeing so many companies in a week and it's quite possible that you don't get a proper audience.
I see. When I'm just looking at the winner and saying only one person won, you're telling me, no, it's more people won. Even the people who came in 10th place and 11th place had an opportunity to raise money from the investors in the audience who are looking to see who is doing well.
Yes.
I see. All right. So we talked about the money. We talked about the idea. We talked about the bank account. How do you get your first users? Do you start building the product first and then getting users, or are you looking for users before? What was your process?
Okay. So we started building the product in October 2010. Mm-hmm. So we just had a simple website with a sign-up form or a sign-up for beta form.
Before you built anything, it was just a standard sign up for beta access.
Yes, there was the product was being built in parallel. So I just thought we'll collect some potential users, and once it's ready, we would probably contact them and show them what we have.
Okay.
And we didn't have anything at the time, but something really interesting happened on March 18th, 2011. So this was again, as I told you, we were participating in the AppSumo Lean Startup Challenge. There was a $50,000 cash prize and where you had to write a blog post on how your startup is a lean startup. And there are also a lot of other prizes like AWS credit and so on. So I actually wrote a blog post about how a simple comment on Hacker News made me quit my job and start a startup. And I actually posted it on Hacker News itself. And like, I think that was probably one of the lucky things that I did, meaning because when I did that, the Hacker News community really, really liked the story because it was a startup that was born from a Hacker News comment. So we stayed on the top as the top post on Hacker News for, I think, like 8 hours, and on the top 10 or top 30 for like more than 1.5 days, which was pretty huge in terms of traffic for us. In 2 days, March 18th and 19th, we got close to 30,000 people coming to our website, and we didn't have any product. And so 175 people, I think, had signed up for the trial.
Just because of that post?
Yeah, just because of the blog post in 2 days. And to give you context, between October and March, only 125 people had signed up. So in 2 days, another 100. So we had 300 people who have signed up, and we didn't have the product. So I actually talked to my team, and then we thought, okay, there are so many people showing up on our door, and if we don't, and these are Hacker News people who would give us good feedback, so let's try to engage. So let's scope down and try to get something out the door. So the next week or four or five days, we just worked a day and night to kind of ship a private beta, like, or you can call it an alpha. So we just wanted to show it to those people who had signed up. And so we got it ready by March 24th. And I started sending out the product to like 10 people, 15 people at a time, because I was actually scared. What happens if I send to all 300 and they all come and the product crashes?
So that sounds like a smart move, though, doesn't it? To just say, I'm not going to email it to everyone. I'll send it to a few, get some feedback, and then adjust and adjust and adjust, right? Instead of doing a big mailing to all of them.
Yeah, but I didn't do it because it sounded smart.
I did see.
Be scared. And also, but what I realized was we started from the original October signup. So what we realized was you send it to 20 people who signed up in October or November. They don't care in March. Like, nobody was actually reading the email because they had moved on. So probably they had a need in October or November. So basically, some of those early signups didn't never materialize. But by May, when we put out the public beta, like, we had 500 people signed up and evaluating. And so we launched on June 6th or June 7th, I think. So that's how we got it. So.
Did you win that contest?
No, contest. But the biggest win was the Hacker News traction and the attention that it got us. And I would say there were a lot of wins because in that post, I had actually thanked Venture Hack's Naval Ravikant. So he actually wrote a mail to me saying, hey, Girish, thanks for the mention. And do you want intros to VCs who in India? And he actually he asked me to publish Freshdesk in AngelList, which I did, and we got Axel through that. So Axel saw us on AngelList.
Sell partners.
And actually, yeah, Axel partners found us there. So in a way, I think these things cascading effect, right? One thing leads to other, and then that's how we found Axel, or Axel found us.
You know what? I've got to say, the use of Hacker News is really smart. You could have said how I found an idea. You could have said how all these different things led to this creation of this product that I'm working on. But you said, no, Hacker News. And the reason for using Hacker News is smart because it tells the Hacker News community this is about you and they start to vote it up. I feel like most people just don't do that enough. In fact, we should be doing that more. This interview should have started with how Hacker News helped Fresh. Now, you already did that, so we need to come up with a different angle. But that works really well.
I think there's a lesson for most startups there. Mm-hmm. In marketing, the title is really, really important, right? So I've learned that lesson in marketing, and you can learn this from journalism. Like Andrew Chen once said that he tweets the blog title of the blog post, like how a growth hacker is the new VP of marketing. So he first tweets it out to see if it's getting viral uplift. And then if he thinks that's viral uplift, then he writes the blog post. So I think there's a lot of, I keep telling my marketing team, focus on the title, because that's where your readers focus first, and then you have to catch their attention, and then they will come to read the post.
What I'm finding, though, is tagging the the big community helps, or tagging the big person helps tremendously, right? That the Hacker News in the title made sense. If somebody were going to say how growth hacking helped me to do whatever, it might be better to say how, what's that growth hacking community called? Growthhackers.org helped me to do whatever, if it's true. And also mentioning people helps a lot. You talked about how Noah's contest is what inspired you to write that blog post. I remember I was giving one of the prizes for that contest. And of course, not only does he get to say you get this product from Mixergy, but now I have an incentive to promote this contest that he put together. And you did not have the product made when you wrote that blog post.
No.
No, it was just an idea at that point.
Yes.
Interesting. And did you feel like a fraud for talking up an idea before you got to the product itself?
No, we were building the product. And the post was about how our startup is a lean startup. So it was basically we were talking. I also mentioned things.
But most people would say, hey, you know what? It's not really a startup yet. It's just an idea. Or I should wait till I launch it. I should wait till people try it. I should wait till this. I should wait till that. You did it before the product even existed. I think that was impressive.
Yeah, but because there was merit to the lean methodology, like it focused on customer development, it focused on minimum viable product. So I had laid out how we chose a different minimum viable product than what seemed obvious. So I think, okay, it was honestly an attempt to win the $50,000 because, see, you have to keep trying. And sometimes you don't know which stone would hit the fruit, right? So basically.
All right, makes sense. That contest in itself, by the way, was a really good marketing idea. They said that if you wanted to enter the contest, you had to write a blog post, which often meant people were talking about lean startup methodology, which helped Eric Reese, who came up with it, and also referring back to the contest on AppSumo, which helped. I think to vote, you had to tweet out about the winner that you wanted to vote for, about the person that you wanted to win. All right, so now you have this community of people. How long did it take you to build the product, did you say?
9 months.
9 months of working to build it out. Why not launch it sooner? Doesn't the lean methodology say launch a minimum viable product as soon as you can?
Yes, it does. But I think in B2B, the concept of in B2B SaaS, the concept of a minimum viable product sometimes can be a disadvantage. So, for example, if somebody is buying a customer support solution, mm-hmm. they want the whole thing, right? So an SMB customer doesn't want to buy only like say feedback forums or email ticketing or knowledge base. So a lot of entrepreneurs I've seen companies just focus on knowledge base, or companies just focus on like user forums and stuff like that. But when you look at the job description of the customer, so you have to give everything, or at least most of the stuff that helps them do their job better. And SMB customers don't have the budget to buy multiple tools and integrate all of them to kind of make it work. And also, I knew that because I had built 4 help desks, so I knew what was the minimum viable product to be built. So you can actually define minimum viable product in many ways. And today, what I feel is that there are many companies who are mistaking features as minimum viable product. So if you build a feature, that's not a company, right?
I see. But I get how you had a sense of what you should build because you had experience building this type of stuff, this type of software before. But what if you were wrong along the way? Or what if you missed something because you made an assumption that was incorrect? Did you show the software as you were building it to people on your mailing list? Did you show it to potential customers?
Yeah, we had a public beta. Like, in fact, I was personally demoing the software to customers, and it was some of these customers who gave us the idea for multi-brand support, which was non-existent. So,
meaning if we have both Mixergy.com and TrueMind.com, we should be able to manage them both within one account, not two different accounts.
Yes, and for your support agents, it would be one interface, but for your customers of Mixergy, will not be seeing the TrueMinds.
I see.
And vice versa.
So within this 9 month period of building out the software, at what point did you invite potential customers in to see it? Was it month eight?
No, it was starting from end of March. So 6 months.
Oh, 6 months into it. And the first customer who saw it, did they say anything that was brand new to you, or did you know everything by then?
No, the first customer who saw it is now a very good friend. His name is Luke Catlin.
Okay.
And so he actually was he really liked it. He gave a lot of feedback, but it took us a year to get him on board as a customer. So he didn't come
interesting
immediately, but he was always talking and interested to see, but asking for more features and so on.
So what kind of feedback did he give you that helped you when you were building out the product before you launched it, before the end of the 9-month development cycle?
Yeah, so one of the things is he was pretty knowledgeable about the industry, and he had evaluated almost every help desk software out there and actually written a blog post about his experience with most of the software. So in one sense, it was a personal challenge to me to kind of get him as a customer, because I know that if somebody who has reviewed like 6 or 7 different help desk software and given his opinion and all of that, and then he finally settled on Freshdesk, that would be a good win. So I think his main contribution today, I'm trying to remember, he was running like 2 startups together at the same time, like Pink Office and
it doesn't matter.
Yeah, Virtual Office and Pink Office. So he wanted the multi-brand. So that was the number one requirement that he gave. And also, there are he told us how he liked the user interface much better than others and so on. So.
Okay. All right. And then you finally launched it. How did the response go?
Yeah, I think it was, I wouldn't say it was a big bang launch, but it was a steady trickle. So we launched it on June 7th. On June 10th, we got our first customer from Australia, and he's still a customer. Like it was Atwell College, and it was just the customer coming to the website, not even talking to us, spending 2.5 hours on the product after signing up, and then putting his credit card and purchasing the product. So I think there was one big lesson that I can probably tell customers, entrepreneurs today, is that when I see a lot of new startups coming to me, so I think what we did was we focused on the business model right from day one. But today I see a lot of entrepreneurs who go around selling personally, like they go and the CEO travels to customers and then makes the sales pitch and they get the first 10, 12 customers. But actually their business model, they would say, is completely online customer acquisition and so on. So the transition from the founder selling to the actual business model, I think in our case, it started off, I didn't meet any customers personally face-to-face till we had more than 200, 300 customers. So.
And you're saying if you're going to sell online, it's better to start by selling online so you can practice doing it and get feedback through that process and then improve the online sales process.
Right.
Or that's what worked for you.
If you're going face-to-face, pretty at least realize that till you actually prove out your business model, you're not yet ready to scale.
How did you live for so long? You had a mortgage, you had expenses, you had 2 kids, you had a family. How do you live for, it was at least 9 months before you can actually start seeing cash?
Yeah, so I also had savings. Like, for example, I used to work in the US for 2 years between 2007 mm-hmm. to 2009. So, and luckily I didn't like get into a big home or whatever. I stayed in a 2-bedroom apartment. I was living in Austin, Texas, where the rents are pretty reasonable. At that time, it was like $1,000 and not too much. So I think I had some savings, and all of that helped. And we were also, my early co-founders or the first early employees, all of them took reasonable pay cuts. Like me and Shan didn't take any salary. And then the first other 4 employees actually came for 30% of their last wow. salary. So, and I think they're all well compensated with stock now, and they're not complaining.
Wow. I want to ask you about revenues today, but we'll get to that in a moment. What I need to talk about now is the time when Excel gave you a term sheet, but the money doesn't come into your account the next day. Till how long afterwards?
So in our case, the term sheet was signed on August 28th, and mm-hmm. the money actually came on October 28th, so 2 months, because also because they were doing it from the new fund, so we were the first investment from their, I think, 2nd or 3rd fund. So it was 2 months, and I would say that was the most stressful period, because you know that you're going to get the money and you start planning big things, and we went and did a deposit for a bigger office. And then the money in the bank account is dwindling. We've also made offers to some really experienced people and higher offers. And so I think I would say in the whole lifespan of Freshdesk, the most stressful part for me was the time between getting the first term sheet and getting the money in the bank.
Because you ran out of money.
We didn't run out of money. We were almost there.
Almost so, there. How close did you come to losing?
So basically, I couldn't have run payroll on November 1st.
And are the partners encouraging you? Are they telling you, don't worry, the money's on its way? And are you worrying? Are you saying, hey, you know what? Maybe these guys are lying. Maybe it's just not true. Maybe there's some problem.
So actually, I used to talk to Axel, and they were very reassuring, saying, hey, we have never walked out of a term sheet, and don't worry, the money will be there. But as the first time entrepreneur and the first time VC funding experience, so it was still, no matter what, how much comfort the investor is giving, it was a little bit stressful in terms of not being able to run payroll, right? But I think it all happened. So it actually came in on Diwali day. I don't know if you know, Diwali is a big festival of lights in India. So it was really a happy Diwali for us.
I bet. $1 million. You were brand new to raising money at the time. According to Crunchbase, now you have $45.1 million in funding over, or at least you got that over five rounds, right?
Actually, I think there is some incorrect data there. It's $44 million in funding. And
they're now listing 45.1. I misread it. Does that sound right?
It was 44 million of VC funding. And I think they are counting the 50K and the 40K. Probably they made some mistake there. So it's 44 million and 50K is the angel money from my friends.
So you obviously got better. How did you get so good at raising money?
So I think probably people liked our story. I think
When someone puts down $25,000, he likes your story. When they're putting in over $44 million, there's more than a story. What was it that got you better at this and allowed you to raise more?
So I think, basically one of the things we have shown is, first thing is we checked all the boxes, right? We had a good management team in place who had the experience. We were in a large market. We demonstrated capability to build a good product and also get traction. So we were constantly growing customers and growing rapidly. And in comparison to most of the other companies in our space, our unit economics are really, really better in terms of cost of customer acquisition or payback ratios. So we are running a better business than most SaaS companies. So I think that's the overall messaging around the team, the product, the traction, and the metrics is what is driving it.
How do you get so many customers? You really have gotten phenomenal at that too. You're saying, look, the funding came because we got the customers. So I want to come back and ask, how do you get the customers?
So, our focus is on the mid-market and lower. So, and when you start a business from India, you don't really have a choice. You have to go global from day one. Usually when somebody starts a company in the US, they start focusing on the US market, get to $10 million of revenue before they branch out to Europe or Australia, right? And I've seen this play out. Companies that start in the Europe actually try to grow in Europe. And then once they reach a certain size, then they start expanding. Same thing with Australia. But if you're sitting in India, there's no choice. You have to focus on going global, unless you are in consumer space. In B2B, I think it's better to focus on global, and that's what we did. So when you have a good product in a broad vertical and you're using online acquisition, and you're targeting a global market, I think it's...
So how do you get customers? I know one thing that you do really well is retargeting, because frankly, when I'm on my iPhone at night reading things to go to sleep, I see your ads. You clearly are retargeting me because I've been on your site. What else are you good at? What else can you say, this is why we're bringing in customers?
Okay, this question has come to me probably 100 times from investors, from other entrepreneurs, from journalists. So I think everybody is looking for a silver bullet to acquire customers. And I also had asked this question when I was early in the early days. But the real answer is there is no one source, but there are probably like 250, 300 different sources from which we get customers. So it's like really the long tail of online acquisition.
What's the biggest source of all these long tail?
I would say Google AdWords and SEO. So basically, so our PR also drives a lot of organic traffic. Our SEO drives a lot of organic traffic. Our AdWords drives traffic. We have listings in a lot of category websites, like directories, like GitHub and Alternative 2 and stuff like that. So, and then we also have banner ads. We use display ads as a way of branding and lead gen. So I think it's a combination. I don't think anybody in our category can actually say, okay, this is the one thing that will help you get all your customers going into it.
So how did you learn to do all of this really well, or to hire people who are good at all of these things? Because frankly, AdWords is competitive enough that that's a challenging space to be in, and you're not going up against amateurs there. PR is challenging enough if you live in Silicon Valley and you're friends with TechCrunch editors and Wall Street Journal editors, but you didn't have that. So how did you get to be good at all this?
So I think I've spent 10 years doing this before Freshdesk. So basically we built a business unit from India. In fact, in 2003, I discovered that you could actually build product from India and use Google AdWords for marketing. It was like cocaine at that time, where the whole company budget was $50 a month. And I started playing around with it. And so it went all the way up to, say, $2,000, $3,000 per day, where we could really see how much we could stretch. And we had built a lot of, so there is a lot of talent in Google AdWords in India. And I had some of my friends who are coming and setting this up for Freshdesk. So that is definitely an area of expertise for us. And so we had the people, we knew how to do it. So,
okay.
So
basically, I don't want to underestimate what you learned when you worked for Zoho. Zoho is a huge company, right? That I remember when I interviewed the founder of Zoho, it was because I read a Forbes article saying, here's the smartest unknown Indian entrepreneur. And I said, this company had been right in front of my eyes for years. I completely underestimated how big they were until somebody, in this case Forbes, pointed it out to me. So that is a big thing for you. What about PR? Zoho was never as good at PR. There's a reason why the founder was considered the smartest unknown Indian entrepreneur. You're fantastic at PR. When somebody, when a reporter mentioned how Freshdesk was copying Zendesk, you jumped on it. You created a website to deal with it. That takes some PR skill. Where did that come from?
I don't know.
Or did you hire someone to do that?
Oh, that was me.
That was you. This is Ben Kepps.
Ben Kepps,
who said, it seems to me like Freshdesk is an unethical troll trying to cash in on Zendesk's good name, but that could just be me. And then instead of just saying, people tweet, even journalists tweet, you made it into this really interesting page where you said, here are the tweets, here are what people are saying about us. No one owns the name Desk here. All these other companies that use the word Desk. And you just jumped right in. You even said, look, Ben has actually blogged for Zendesk. All stuff that people would have said internally, but you made it into a page that was shareable, that allowed people to see why you guys are the feisty underdogs that they should support. And that's a great PR move. And so you're saying that just came to you. You had that idea.
No, I would actually say that it was I'll give you the whole scenario. So this happened on December 2nd, 2011. December 1st was when we announced the Accel funding. So probably somebody was attacking us as soon as they saw the Accel funding news, right? And to be honest, some of our employees were really upset and they wanted to take the fight back on Twitter and respond. So I was not thinking about this as a PR opportunity. I was just thinking about this as how should we respond? And instead of just being trigger happy and fighting it out, I asked our team to hold back and let's think about what's happening and let's try to see what's the best course of action. And I think the idea was actually from our marketing person called Srilesh, who still is our director of marketing. And so he and I talked and we wanted to do something. We didn't want to just ignore it. At the same time, we didn't want to go and reply on Twitter. So we actually, the December 2nd, I think, was a Friday. So we worked all through night on Friday and Saturday. We also got our investors' permission to do this because we felt that it was the right thing to do. And we actually went out with a site called ripofornot.org. I think it went out on Sunday. So, again, this was, we posted it on Hacker News, and like people really came out and supported us. And when on Monday morning, when India woke up, like it was even more momentum, because there was so many Indian entrepreneurs who actually started supporting us. So I think we didn't think about it as PR. It turned out to be a great PR move, but it was more like doing the right thing. So somebody is accusing us wrongly. So what should we do about it? How do we give them a fitting reply? So that was what drove it.
What about this guy, Shankar Ganesh? This guy is the most determined person I ever have seen. He's been emailing me for, let me see how long, 2 years almost, a year and a half at least. Constant follow-up. You've got to have our CEO on Mixergy. One of the least, it's not annoying at all. It's just really smooth in the way that he does it. Says, listen, he's going to be in San Francisco. How about we record in person? And that's why this happened today, because you happen to be here in San Francisco. We're not recording in person because I still do it all via Skype. But where do you find this guy?
Okay, so here's the interesting part of Shankar, right? So he graduated out of college in 2013. Mm-hmm. So like he's really a kid. But I had first known about him when he had interned for Zoho, but I didn't meet him at Zoho. I was in the managing division, and I was in the US, I think, or I was not interacting with him. But after I started Freshdesk, somebody told me that you should probably talk to him. He's a smart, talented kid. He was still in college, and he actually was sitting in a village. The college was in the middle of a village in India. And he was networking all around the world. Like when I was in TechCrunch Disrupt New York, like he would connect me to a CEO of a European startup.
Why? Like, why did he do those kind of connections?
No, he was a friend when I was actually, he was not yet working for us, but he was a natural networker. So that's what I was trying to tell you about. Like he knew that we were doing the startup and he wanted to help. And he was actually interning for another company doing a sales role. So he was actually pitching me for that product. And then once he was connected, he knew that we were going to TechCrunch Disrupt, and he just connected saying you guys should meet or whatever. So for me, I am a big believer in core talent, right? And for me, PR is changing. Like social is disrupting PR, and I'm not the first person saying this, right? So somebody who's good with social connections can directly reach out to journalists and people like you and actually build those relationships and get things done. So I could see Shankar would be a great PR person, but he didn't believe it. And then when I made him an offer, like he refused to join Freshdesk because he said Freshdesk is a growing company and he wanted to be in a smaller startup which has only 6 people and he would learn a lot there. Then I had to send him Paul Graham's article on startup equal to growth. So I have to tell him, okay, you have to differentiate between a fast-growing startup and a successful startup will become bigger. It doesn't have to stay at 6 people. He was thinking. And then we had to do, it was like almost a one-year project for us to
recruit him, to convince him that you're worth working for. I see. So you're saying he's just a natural networker, naturally gifted at this stuff, and that's why he stayed in touch with me. I'm glad that you said that he turned you down, because I turned him down. I think you even did a pre-interview, and then we were trying to schedule a time, and I couldn't make it work. And I said, and he kept pushing, and I said, I'm sorry, I just can't do this interview. And still he persisted. He is good, that guy. The thing I'm wondering, though, is why? Why does he work that hard? I live here in San Francisco. I know why people work so hard, because they are hoping to either get shares in a business that will make them into something big, or because they want to learn. And this is often more than anything else. They want to learn from the entrepreneur how he did it, and they're going to spend a few years working with them and then go start their own thing. What's the motivation that your people have for working as hard as Shankar does? What's the attitude? What's the goal?
So I think if you're my philosophy is when you enjoy doing what you're doing, it's not hard work. Work becomes play. That's the core of our culture, actually. So when we hire people, I always look for core talent, because I like a lot of times though, all these fancy degrees don't matter. So when what I believe in is what we all believe in is if somebody is really good in creative writing, right? So you have to put them in a role that taps on that talent. Somebody is good in speaking or articulation, like you, they have to be doing that because they're enjoying it. See, Andrew, you're doing these interviews because you enjoy talking to people, probably, right? And I couldn't do what you're doing day in, day out. So once you find out what is their core talent or what is their natural strength, and then you map the roles to those strengths, you're actually unlocking people's potential. So they're actually, work doesn't become burden, work becomes play. So I think that's what is happening. I can show you a lot more examples. Like there's a marketer called Ramesh so.
I see. You're saying that when you tap into what someone is really passionate about and what they do exceptionally well, you don't need all this external motivation. The internal motivation's already been tapped, and that's what's firing them off.
Yes.
I see. Do you have another example of that? And then I'll ask one last question and we'll be done, because okay. I know we're going to be done.
Give you another story about a girl called Anna, a woman called Anna, whom we hired. we hired her fresh out of college in 2012. She was really smart, had good communication skills, spoken and written, was a natural talker, and we were hiring her for this marketing position, right? I then put her in marketing, in creative marketing, Marcom. And it so happened that she was not good at marketing writing, because you know that marketing writing is slightly different. So she was not able to do any creative marketing, and the manager was upset, and he moved her to another team. And then this time it was SEO, and it was still in marketing, but SEO writing and stuff like that, which she didn't enjoy. The manager was not happy, and good work was not getting produced. So literally she was in tears, because she had spent a few months, like 4-6 months at the company, and we had tried two things and nothing worked out, and she was feeling that she was not contributing anything. I had promised her at the time of interview that we would figure out what you're good at. And so I thought, I still believe that her communication was good and she talks really well. I couldn't find out why she wouldn't fit in marketing, but I thought, okay, let's try her in customer support, right? So she actually took to customer support like fish takes to water, right? So she was really, really good, had tremendous ownership. She built tremendous rapport with customers. Customers used to call the support line and ask for Anna, and her emails were perfectly written with a lot of detail orientation, with a lot of empathy, and the icing on the cake was when she won the Customer Success Hero Award that was given out by Tutango, where customers nominated her, and she was the only person from outside the USA to win it. She won it remotely from Chennai, India. And I think that was an example where when you unlock somebody's natural, see, she could have been in marketing and been a misfit, right? She had an offer in a large IT company as a programmer, which she didn't want to do. That's why she came to Freshdesk. So what we believe in is there are no bad employees. There are only bad fits. And we try hard to match people to the role where we can unlock their true potential.
Do you have a book you can recommend on how to find the right people or how to manage people? Because I do think you've got an exceptional skill at that.
Yeah, I think I would. All my learning in this has started from a book called First Break All the Rules. So, and this book actually, I'll just give you one concept that stuck in my mind over the years in this book. It's the difference between skill, knowledge, and talent. So it's pretty simple, right? Learning how to use Adobe Photoshop is skill, but actually having the design sense or the color sense is talent. Or knowing how to program in Ruby on Rails is probably skill, but being a good programmer is talent. So what this book says is skill is teachable. Knowledge, there are two types of knowledge, factual knowledge and experiential knowledge. Again, experiential knowledge is more difficult to teach, it comes with experience. But talent is what is really hard to teach. The book actually says you can't put in what God intentionally left out, right? And I love the statement, because that's where most of the problems at the work culture happen, when people are not playing to their strength. And that's why we are trying to unlock the core talent. So whether it's creative writing or articulation or analytical skills or design skills, we try to find out what really is the strength of the person and then try to map them to the right role.
That's by Marcus Buckingham. I didn't read that book, but I did read one of his other books about how you should discover your own strengths. And that's been key to everything he said for years about management and about personal growth. Great suggestion. I think Facebook uses his teachings to help guide the way that they manage too. All right, my final question is this. What kind of revenues are you guys doing? You're really good at customer acquisition. Investors clearly love being a part of your business. You're drawing customers in. How many and what kind of revenue are you getting?
So as a private company, we still don't disclose revenues. But I would say, I can tell you that we have crossed 40,000 customers. And we have customers in 145 countries. And we have been growing.
You crossed 30,000 paying customers.
So right now, totally. We also have a freemium plan, so it's totally 40,000 now.
30,000 people, including 40, the Sprout plan, which is $0 a month.
Yeah, 40,000.
I see. How many paying customers?
So it's a good, healthy percentage of that.
Okay. Are you guys over 10 million yet in sales annual?
Yes.
You are. All right. Well, congratulations. I'm not going to push any more on that. I know that you guys are keeping that stuff private, but the company is doing really well. I keep hearing about it, and your prices are still fantastically low, which I'm not sure how you do. All right. Thank you so much for doing this interview, everybody. The site is freshdesk.com if you want to check them out, not us.
Thanks so much, Andrew,
for doing this interview.
It was great talking to you. Thanks.
And I got to thank your guy here. I've got to thank Shankar for putting this together. That guy is fantastic at follow-up. I got an email from him just 5 days ago with more and more research on you. I've never seen anyone work like him. Anyway, I'm proud to work with him, and I'm proud to know you. Thank you, and thank you all for being a part of Mixergy.
Thanks, everyone. Andrew.